Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is just one segment of today's show. You can hear all of our conversations about New York's vibrant cultural scene on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and as we observe Mozart's 250th birthday this week, we'll be exploring some of the more esoteric uses of his music. By far the most controversial is the claim that Mozart's music can enhance your brain power. That notion was first given scientific support in a 1993 article in the journal Nature, which found that college students who listened to this piece, Mozart's Sonata in D for two pianos, performed better on a spatial reasoning test. This almost inevitably became known as the Mozart effect, a theory that has since been debunked, but has also been taken in new directions by other researchers. In a moment, we'll speak with John Hughes, a professor of neurology at the University of Illinois Medical Center at Chicago. He has conducted research showing that Mozart can treat comatose epilepsy patients. But first, we'll be joined on the phone by Chip Heath. He teaches organizational behavior at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and in 2004 published his research tracking the evolution of the so-called Mozart effect. Chip, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So the Mozart effect has come under pretty sharp attack by many scientists since 1993. Why is it still so popular?
Yeah, my part of the puzzle is to say, why would we believe the Mozart effect even if it's not true? And so we started with the article that you referenced. In 1993, there was a very prominent article in a very famous scientific magazine called Nature. And over the next 8 or 10 years, the Mozart effect became widely known. Now, scientists would always like to believe that their research is going to be widely known by the public, but most of the time it doesn't happen. And so why did this idea become so popular, especially when later on it was questioned by subsequent research that said, well, maybe there's not a Mozart effect at all?
Well, so what? I mean, you did the research. What's the answer?
So the approach that we took is to say that there are anxieties that we have, especially as parents, about how our kids are developing. And so what we, in one of our studies, we looked at all of the mentions of the Mozart effect in every state paper in every state in the United States. And what we found is that in states where states pay their teachers less than the national average, in states that have historically performed poorly on national tests of reading or English use in grade schools, it's in those states that there are more people mentioning Mozart effect in the state newspapers. And our interpretation of that result is that because we're anxious as parents and as community members about how our kids are developing intellectually, in situations where we have that anxiety in our state, we're more likely to grasp onto something like the Mozart effect because it looks like an easy solution to a pervasive problem that we might want to fix some other more complicated way. But as parents, maybe we don't know how to do that.
But, I mean, I guess one of the things with the original research, as I understand it, which was done at the University of Wisconsin by Frances Rauscher, is that she wasn't looking at kids, young kids or babies or anything like that. She was looking at college students.
Exactly. So an original study, and when the first article started coming out about the Mozart effect, it made it clear that it was about college students, and there was a temporary effect on, as you said, the spatial reasoning task.
Right. A modest one, too. It wasn't like a huge IQ increase or anything
exactly.
Like that.
And the spatial reasoning task is an interesting task, but it's essentially I show you how we fold a piece of paper several times, and then I cut that piece of paper, and then I ask you to imagine what it would be like unfolded. Now, clearly it takes some smarts to think about that, but it's a fairly limited area of intelligence. And so what's amazing is that the story that was about college students, a small temporary effect on spatial intelligence, became a story about kids having long-term effects on general intelligence.
So it's like that that game Telephone, where, you know, if you pass a message along often enough, you get a really garbled version of it at the end.
Exactly. And so if you look at newspaper articles, the first articles were all about college students. 80% of them mentioned the original population in the experiment. About 30% of them mentioned implications for kids. By 8 years later, the ratio had reversed. 80% of the articles were about kids, and only 30% mentioned college students. And probably the most interesting effect was that about half of the articles by the later period of time mentioned babies. And to my knowledge, and we've reviewed the literature pretty extensively, there has never been a study about the effects of listening to classical music or Mozart on babies.
Well, and I believe Frances Rauscher herself has, you know, sort of at some point just kind of like threw up her hands and said, look, I didn't do this. This is not what my test was about.
Yeah, when I exchanged emails with her after our article came out, she talked about an event where the state governor of Georgia basically passed a bill to distribute free classical music CDs to every new mother that goes home with a baby from a hospital in the state of Georgia. And she said that the politicians that were thinking about the bill had called her and tried to get her to comment on this. And she said, you're going way beyond the science. And they said, well, we just want to push the envelope a little bit on this. And from her perspective, it was pushing the envelope way too far because we've never done any research on babies.
Not that there's anything wrong with the state giving classical music CDs to anybody. But
there's lots of good reasons for that.
But yeah.
Probably not because of intellectual development.
Okay. We're speaking with Chip Heath, Associate Professor of Organizational Behavior at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Chip, are you familiar with Don Campbell?
I am.
What do you think of, first of all, if you plug into your computer mozarteffect.com, you basically go to Don Campbell's website, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so what do you make of Mozart for Babies and all of the other Mozart effect stuff that that this guy has parlayed into quite a successful business?
Yeah, I think he's a brilliant entrepreneur, but he's skating on pretty thin ice as far as the science goes. And we give him a lot of credit, especially in this country, whenever you see an article about the Mozart effect. It's very likely to quote one of Don Campbell's books where he's argued that that playing Mozart's music and playing classical music has these profound effects on intellectual development. But this is an idea that has taken off in lots of other places in the world. So my wife and I adopted a daughter from China a couple of years ago, and while we were there, we found a CD in a street-side CD rack that had a picture of little baby hands lifting up into the heavens with big Chinese characters that we couldn't read, but they had helpfully provided an English translation. It said, Mozart makes baby more clever.
Wow. All right. Well, Don Campbell has produced a number of tomes and a number of CDs, including this one, Mozart for Babies, Volume 1, From Playtime to Sleepy Time. This is the music for playtime. It's the Toy Symphony by Mozart's dad, a far less inventive composer, Leopold Mozart. All right. Well, when you get to music for sleepy time, you actually do get to some of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's music. I suppose, Chip Heath, though, you know, the question is, if people are going to make claims like this and they have been, you know, misstated and then restated in, as you point out, in newspapers and magazines for years now, why hasn't anybody actually gone back and done research about the effect of Mozart on babies and young kids?
I think it's an interesting question. I mean, one reason is that it's just really hard to do research with babies. It's hard to get them to pay attention. It's hard to get them to listen to their parents, much less a classical symphony, for long enough to kind of test the intellectual development. And so generally what we do when we do research is use older subjects and hope that our conclusions extrapolate back towards kids.
I suppose hope is not a particularly compelling scientific component when you're putting
exactly.
a hypothesis together.
And that's why developmental psychologists, when they pick out topics to study, they know that they're going to be investing in a topic for several years to get enough babies to pay attention during an experiment so that we know something.
Okay. So to summarize so far, Chip Heath with us from Stanford Graduate School of Business, he published The Mozart Effect, Tracking the Evolution of a Scientific Legend, in the British Journal of Social Psychology in 2004. And so your contention is that this hypothesis was the result of parents being anxious about their kids and education, the state of education. And so the Mozart effect however misconstrued it was, seemed like something that people could latch on to.
That's right. And okay. So that to us explains why we see more mentions of it in states where the education system seems to be struggling. It tells us why the story evolved from being a story about college students in an experiment to being stories about kids and about babies.
All right. Now, let me ask you this. Isn't it possible to simply argue that there is a Mozart effect, that if you listen to Mozart and you like it, that it will raise your, it'll lift your spirits, it helps your mood, and whatever task you have at hand, you will therefore be more proficient at because you're fully engaged, your senses are alert, and you're just in a better mood.
I could certainly buy that. I mean, music is wonderful. It intrigues us, it challenges us, it makes us happy. Those are all things that are valuable parts of being human and valuable parts of life. But we could say the same thing about our kids. I mean, they intrigue us, they challenge us, they make us happy. But I don't think anybody's ever claimed that having children makes us smarter. On average, the complaint is the opposite. That,
I'm right there with you, Chip. Okay. Before we bring in John Hughes, a researcher who says that he has found some very specific uses for Mozart's music, let me just mention that we will be taking your calls as well and your emails on this topic. Our phone number, 212-264-7483, and our email address is soundcheck@wnyc.org. Chip Heath is the Associate Professor of Organizational Behavior at Stanford Graduate School of Business, and joining us now is John Hughes, Professor of Neurology at the University of Illinois Medical Center in Chicago. John has found that Mozart may have some specific kinds of health benefits. John, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, you treat patients with severe epilepsy, and tell us what you discovered about, people who have epileptic seizures and the effect that Mozart's music in particular has.
Well, I'd like to tell you how I got involved in this. I was giving a national talk on what we can call musicogenic epilepsy, and this is the opposite effect of what we're going to talk about further. These were patients who had seizures associated with a given musical selection. And following me was a man named Dr. Shaw, Dr. Gordon Shaw from University of California, who had been a physicist, retired from being a physicist, and thought he would like to tackle coding in the brain, and decided to study music as a means of discovering coding of the brain. He talked about the Mozart effect. Well, I was interested in his paper, and he was interested in mine. And so we got together afterwards, and he gave me a copy of his Kerschel 448 that you have played in part.
That's the piece that that Francis Rauscher used in
That's
the original
right.
Mozart effect study.
That's right.
Okay.
And so this was the weekend, of course, and I went into work on Monday, and we had a patient who was in status epilepticus. Now, for your audience, some of them may know that this means one seizure after another, and it's a very serious condition. And so I thought, I wonder what would happen while I record the electroencephalogram, and I'm an electroencephalographer and epileptologist both, I wonder what would happen if we started to play 448. Well, before the music came on, 62% of the time, this patient was in seizure activity, and oh my, that is really bad status epilepticus. And when the music came on, I was amazed what happened. The epileptic activity reduced to around, on the average, of around 20%. I could hardly believe it, and we played the music for about 10 minutes and then stopped it, and of course then the epileptic activity did return, not the whole way to 62%, but to 50%. And so this intrigued me a great deal, and from then on I looked at all kinds of patients who were in seizure at the time or who had a very, very active epileptic focus. And the way to view a focus is that it's like the ticking of a time bomb. And ordinarily, these discharges, these epileptic discharges, will come through at 1 to 2 per second, and then they may cascade into a clinical seizure that you can see. But meanwhile, the EEG records these discharges. And any time that you see a patient with that rapid type of discharge, they will not be really very, very attentive. And therefore, all the patients that we dealt with We were looking at very hard data, either ictal rhythm, that means the seizure rhythm itself on an EEG, or what we call the interictal rhythm, namely the discharges in between the seizures that would rapidly come. And I would simply count how many ictal rhythms, how many interictal discharges would appear, and then what would happen when the Mozart music would be present.
John, at the risk of oversimplifying this, are you suggesting that there's something in the rhythmic information in Mozart that kind of helps to regulate the rhythms that you're measuring in these people who are suffering from these epileptic seizures?
Absolutely. I spent a couple years gathering all these data, but we had as many as 12 computers going at the same time, John, trying to figure out what is distinctive about Mozart music. And we found there were two particular characteristics that I think helped to explain it. The first one, and not the most important, was the long-term periodicity mm-hmm. of amplitude. It may not be evident to the listener, but if you look at it technically, you will find that Mozart music and also Johann Sebastian Bach and Christian Bach, they were the leaders in periodic changes of volume. But the most important thing was the melodic line and the repetition of the melodic line. And here's where we needed all 12 computers, and we did it in a very fancy way. But we looked at over 2 million notes from all the major composers, and we scored each of these selections according to how much of a repetition there was of the melodic line. And Mozart proved to be way ahead of anyone else. The closest one was, by the way, Haydn.
Does that mean that Mozart is more repetitive than anyone else?
Because yes, but we don't get tired or bored with it, John, because Mozart, I believe, was the greatest genius in the history of the world, and he knew how to make it interesting. He could turn it inside out, upside down, backwards, and whatever. It would still be the melodic line, but it would be considered by our brains very fascinating.
Right. We actually just on this program the other day had Rob Capello here pulling apart Eine kleine Nachtmusik and how the apparently simple repetitions of the theme are actually subtly different. So sort of going to your point, John. John Hughes, we'll speak more in a moment with him, the neurologist at the University of Illinois Medical Center in Chicago. We also want to get Chip Heath's response to all of this. And, of course, we want to take your calls on the so-called Mozart effect. We are listening to the piece that started it all, the piece used by Frances Rauscher in her initial study, the Sonata for Two Pianos, Kerschel number 448, and you're listening to Soundcheck. So give us a call. What do you think of the Mozart effect? Are there benefits? Are you a skeptic? Our number is 212-264-7483. That's 264-7483. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're talking about the Mozart effect, science fact or science fiction. Chip Heath is the author of The Mozart Effect, I should say co-author of The Mozart Effect with Adrian Baumgartner, tracking the evolution of a scientific legend and how the whole thing has sort of been blown out of proportion over the years since the original study in 93. John Hughes is a neurologist at the University of Illinois Medical Center in Chicago who has found that Mozart in particular is quite beneficial to patients who are suffering severe epileptic seizures. Actually, John, I suppose many of these people are in comas when you're actually playing the music for them, right?
Oh, that was one of the major points, John, to get away from the point that you raised and appropriately did so, that namely that Mozart music would lift your spirits, as you said, and you would be fully engaged. We can't explain this effect on the patients who have the seizures based upon that because most of them were in coma or semi-coma.
So there's no question of their mood being elevated. This was
exactly.
a kind of a physical effect.
It's a physical effect, and I think it's important to point out that we do have some physical changes in Mozart music. FMRI, I think many of your listeners will know what that new technique is, whereby you find out exactly what is happening in the brain and where it is happening from a very fancy magnetic resonance instrument. We find that the midfrontal regions light up with Mozart music and not with, say, Beethoven for Elise. That was done out in California. And we did brain mapping on some of our patients, which looks at the electrical activity and its distribution throughout the head. And we found, again, it was the midfrontal region where we had an increase in activity during the Mozart music. So it's a little bit more evidence that really gets to be almost physical with electroencephalographic change and also fMRI change.
Right. Now let me just ask you, have you had the opportunity to do any of this kind of testing on someone who perhaps doesn't come from, you know, the Euro-American culture, for whom Mozart would be a completely alien form of music, someone from Central Asia or Africa or whatever?
Interesting you ask, because one of the major points that I feel very proud of is not only this acute effect, but the chronic effect. A chronic effect, and we did that on a little Japanese girl, about 10 years of age. And yes, she could speak English, but she was from Japanese parents, and she was, I think, born in Japan, although she was going to school at that time in the United States. And we showed that not only is there an acute effect, but there's a chronic effect, whereby we gave her 10 minutes of Mozart music throughout her whole day, and having many, many seizures, we simply counted them, and we found that they reduced in number while she was listening to the Mozart music every hour for 10 minutes. And then even the next day, she had a reduced number. Hmm. But that's a little Japanese girl that I was 10 years old and probably never heard of Mozart.
Or perhaps she'd been playing it on the violin since she was three. I guess you don't know.
Let me
bring Chip Heath back into this. Chip, it seems like in your research into the Mozart effect, that you were looking at bad science and misrepresentation. What do you make of what John has done, where it seems like the research has been, you know, sort of done several times and seems to kind of reinforce the conclusions drawn the first time?
I think it's wonderful. I mean, we need to know much more about the effect of music on people. I mean, music has a profound history with the human race, and we need to understand why this is such a big part. But keep in mind, and we can throw this back to John, but he's doing research on people with profound medical difficulties. There is a physical effect of music, but I don't think he would want to claim that the music of Mozart enhances the intellectual development of kids. It's helping patients with epilepsy have more coherence in their profound medical state.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to get to some calls. Let's start with Mona in Westchester. Mona, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. First of all, I'm a certified music practitioner, and I provide music at the bedside for all types of illnesses and for the actively dying. And I have to say that I play a very small harp for that job, and I can't play Mozart per se, but what has a profound effect on the patient is the rhythmic content and the melodic content and what actually is going on.
So it's not so much you're saying it's almost like it's the fact that there is music happening more than the specifics of what you're playing.
Well, it's how the music is played and how it's geared, because, you know, there are lots of studies by music therapists, for instance, the AMTA, who have found that music affects, you know, the blood pressure, the autonomic responses in the body, your heartbeat, oxygenation, and so forth. So there's a lot going on when people access music, and even a comatose patient still hears the music. And, you know, depending on how you play the music, you can actually reduce agitated breathing, and it's quite profound.
Well, it goes to exactly to what John Hughes has been telling us about the work that he's been doing. Mona, thanks for getting us started with our calls this afternoon. Let's move right along to Dan, who's in Connecticut. Dan, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
What do you think of all this?
Well, I'm actually a little skeptical of the Mozart effect. My mom would like me to think differently, but...
Well, what makes you skeptical about it?
Well,
what in
I like
particular?
I like the point that you raised about music putting you in a good mood and then you performing at a higher, you know, ability.
Mm-hmm.
And I listen to classic rock and roll when I do my homework and stuff and when I'm running. And that always puts me in a better mood and makes me work harder and faster. And I think that it, you know, it's not the music that you listen to or the rhythmic thing. I think it's more just listening to music. And I think it'd be interesting for there to be a study done where they see the effects of rock and roll and classic rock on and compared to the Mozart music.
All right, Dan, let me pose that question to John Hughes. John, have you tried any, you know, anything other than classical music in your studies?
Oh, we certainly did. We, of course, had control music, and one was old-time piano tunes, and the other was some Philip Glass music. And, of course, it didn't do any of the sorts of things that we talked about with Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, of course, that was terribly important. We ran that control music, either the wild Philip Glass music called minimalist music or the sort of elevator music, old-time piano tunes. We had that as a control. It didn't do a darn thing, of course, to the discharges or to the ictal rhythms of the seizure patients.
Is there, I mean, has this, have there been other researchers who've tried to, you know, duplicate your work? I mean, that seems to be kind of standard operating procedure in the scientific community.
Very much so. In fact, down at University of South Carolina, there's a gentleman that has already published confirming the work, and he published this at the American Academy of Neurology, gave the talk there. And it's already been published in a neurological journal,
mm-hmm.
completely confirming it.
And let me come back to the very first thing you said to us was that you got into this because you were doing, it was a talk on music that triggers.
Musicogenic epilepsy. And this is a fascinating area whereby somebody, usually through emotion, will have a great emotional response to a musical selection. A good example was a French policeman that got so interested in his Marseillaise, he would have a seizure every time it played.
Wow.
So that musicogenic epilepsy, and I reviewed the world literature on that, and of course then went into this sort of thing that was the opposite of
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I suppose, and Chip, let me get your reaction to this too. If we know that, you know, certain types of stimuli like lights, strobe lighting, or different types of music can have this sort of physical effect on some people, I guess it stands to reason that you could make a case for music having kind of a beneficial effect on some people as well.
You could certainly make the case, but we'd want to see the evidence for that. I mean, take any rock and roll music video that Dan from Connecticut might enjoy seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think music videos are excellent at doing quick cuts with visual stimuli and musical stimuli and rhythmic stimuli that keep our attention and keep us intrigued. But nobody's out there like Donald Campbell trying to sell music videos to kids to make them smarter.
Right. Okay, let's see if we can take one more call. Nadia in New Jersey, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good. I'm actually a developmental psychology student right now. I'm in grad school, and so this topic is really interesting. But I'm wondering if any researchers, and I'm sure there's studies out there, who have actually looked at what you bring to the table, how what you bring to the table will impact what you get out of the music. So for instance, people who are more attentive or calm, if they're listening to the music, they're going to show or demonstrate greater abilities. So I don't think it's music necessarily. I think it's being calm and rhythmic and mindful and attentive. And when you are doing all those things, you're going to demonstrate greater abilities. So even for epileptics who are getting the music and, you know, they're demonstrating less of the seizures, I think it's because they are in that calm, attentive state.
Well, okay, Nadia, let me ask both John and Chip to weigh in one final time on this. The idea, the sort of the self-selecting nature of that can be something that wrecks a lot of research. It seems, John, that is not the case in yours, though, since these are comatose patients.
Right, and I'd like to add one more thing that's consistent with what the caller had just mentioned, namely that everything that we know about the brain is cyclical and periodic. There's something called the cyclic alternating pattern, for example, that repeats itself when somebody is going to sleep every 20 to 30 seconds, which I thought fit in with the cyclical pattern of the amplitude changes. But everything that we see in the brain has a cyclical or periodic function, and I think the music, particularly Mozart music, locks in with these intrinsic mechanisms of the brain.
Mm. And let me, John, I'm sorry, we're running out of time here, so let me get a final word in from Chip.
Okay.
Chip, the idea that maybe some of the original study had some self-selecting going on there among the students, is that a possible, you know, sort of fly in the ointment?
I'm not sure it necessarily is. I mean, we certainly want to know for younger kids, and in your suggestion for babies, what would be the effects of these things. But up to this point, those studies haven't been done, and so I don't think we want to go off as a culture depending on easy, what appears to be easy solutions for important problems like how do we make our kids develop intellectually.
Right. All right. Well, we've been speaking about the so-called Mozart effect with Chip Heath, Associate Professor of Organizational Behavior at Stanford Graduate School of Business, and with John Hughes, Professor of Neurology at the University of Illinois Medical Center at Chicago. Chip, John, thank you both for a fascinating conversation. There's obviously much more we can talk about, and I hope we can do that at a later date, but thank you both for being with us today. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.